Let's take a look at some of the ways now that Satanism is spreading throughout our society, say here in North America or in Europe.
Well, we're into a new phase, a completely new phase. That's our opinion in this matter. I'll tell you why we call it a new phase. There's no doubt about it that from before the time of Christ, especially during the time of Christ, as the Gospels testify, there has always been possession. Always been possession. And always been exorcism too. The Jewish religion did give a means of exorcism to its priests and wise men. And Christ himself had, being Lord and Master, he could expel devils like that. And remember, he cleaned out 7 devils out of Mary Magdalene. That's a lot of devils. Now, we've always had that. In the Middle Ages, and right down to the Renaissance, and then to the Enlightenment, as they call it, this thing continued. Then, of course, belief in the devil dropped out, and belief in the church dropped out, and Catholicism was limited to certain countries. And then the scientists set about proving there was no such thing as the devil, no such thing as possession, therefore. So the whole idea dropped out. In the meantime, what we have found out is happening. And by the way, this rests as much on the testimony of demons, which we exorcise and have to speak and say what they're doing in life. Because sometimes the people who need to come for exorcism, and this, I must keep my mouth shut after this, on this point, are high up in government or finance. And they've influenced by a lot of people in a lot of countries. And you'd be appalled sometimes by the near accidents we ran with great men and great women. But about that we can't speak an awful lot. But know that it's a fact. Because from all that testimony, from all that factual situation, as well as from what the church tells us, it's quite clear that what Lucifer has concentrated on today is the group organization. There's no doubt about it that running right through our society, say take my own country here, the USA, running right through its society, especially in the public institutions. And by that I mean government offices at the city, state, and federal level. Washington. There's no doubt about it that Lucifer has acquired a phalanx of servitors, of servants in these places who will do his bidding and do his bidding automatically. Some of them I've met, some of them are completely possessed. They do his will from morning until night. And they have a very good time. They have a great success. They have a very good life as far as material things go. So it's influencing groups to do his will. And to do his will in this matter means de-Catholicizing the church, ridding public life of any semblance of religion at all, any religion, not merely Roman Catholicism. But Roman Catholicism is a special enemy because we, he knows, have something the others haven't got. And, you know, Bernard, somebody has said it, and it's true, and it's not a Catholic who said it, if tomorrow the Roman Catholic Church were wiped out completely, the rest of Christianity would fall to pieces. It's the lodestone that holds them all together, finally, and is the norm by which they define themselves. So the mode today is different. It's no longer individuals. It's now whole groups, it's whole governments, it's whole schools, it's whole foundations, it's whole organizations dedicated to promoting the will of Satan along the sexual line, along the art line, along the historical line, along the statecraft line, along the economic line, along the line of, say, junk bonds. It's a funny thing. This is his tactic. And this means that in his plans, in Lucifer's plans, there's a showdown coming, and he's marshalling all the forces possible, and he's succeeding so far. He's got so many servants because he grants them success. They get success. You see, what we now, you and I forget is this, that when you're normally doing your work, but I'm doing my work, and we're doing it decently and as good as we can and as sinlessly as we can, we're getting light from God continually. They call it Lumen Christi, light of Christ. We get it in our brains, our intelligence. Similarly, if I'm serving Satan, he has his own light. He will enlighten. They have their own intuitions, their own instructions, their own light. He gives light and makes them succeed and gives them their pleasures and gives them their successes. Oh, yes. Oh, he's a good leader from that point of view, except that they end up finally burnt to a crisp for eternity. But he does endow them with it, and that's why they're very intelligent. You can't, don't misunderstand, don't underestimate them. They're formidable enemies. And whether it's in the ACLU or the Planned Parenthood Federation or some of the out-and-out homosexual organizations, which even the ordinary homosexual you meet says, my God, that's disgusting. You know that he's got his servitors, and they are very faithful to him.
And it permeates our whole society, even in the music, for example.
Oh, above all in the music, there's nothing more influential than music. I know that, you see, but what is difficult for normal citizens to imagine is this. And this holds for Canada, or for USA, or Australia, or England, or Europe. It holds for those areas, because that's where the Satan is most active at the present moment, according to our statistics. It's very difficult for them to realize that over a period of time, hard to calculate, but certainly in the region of about 150 years, coming to a culmination in the middle of our century, there has grown up an organizational institution kept very private, with membership lists, with centers, with leaders, with a bank balance, with funds, and with great influence, that, like an octopus, is spreading through every one of our public institutions. And whether it's the armed forces, or whether it's the federal government, say, here, or the government in Canada in Toronto, or whatever it is, it is there, and it's planning things. And you can only account for some of the things that are happening in our world by presupposing such a thing exists. We know it exists otherwise. But you'd be led to conclude there was something like that there merely by watching the phenomenon take place. There must be something coordinating all that, because it's all moving in one direction. The direction is terrible, Bernard. You probably are too young. I'm not putting rank on you. I'm complimenting you to know that you're used to change today. I mean, there's a change every week and every month. But when I was young, there was no such thing. Every decade was a tin type of the previous decade. Somebody has so arranged world affairs that now it's in flux always. We have been forced to get used, to get accustomed, to change, perpetual change. That's not only in our politics, but in our lives. The job system today requires you to travel. You have to travel. The job system requires the husband to go to Seattle and the wife to stay in Oklahoma, because that's the only way they can make their money work.
And people change jobs every 2 or 3 years now.
And they move. Although he moves or she moves, the family stays behind. I know that's an arrangement that's taking place today. That's why I have, so I think, not half our families, but it's near one half our families are one-parent families. But there's this change. And then another change which has been instituted, this will show the extent of this octopus, is this, that we have now got used to the fact that people will wear clothes, slacks, men and women, and jeans, which will show all the contours of their bodies. And we have to get used to that. And the videos, the advertisements you see, whether you're on television over there or here, they are showing things which my grandmother and grandfather would fall to pieces over. We have become we don't blink an eyelid at it any longer. A nude, a naked, a very revealing dress, a male body almost showing all the relevant parts of it. We don't care. We've been made to get used to that. That's what they do nowadays. Language, the four-lettered words that are in English, you just can't afford to be shocked if you're going to listen to TV. You can't afford to be shocked because they're going to use every one of them. They've made you used to it. Another effect. A third effect is that now, if you lift your eyebrows at a dinner table, certainly in America, except in very fundamentalist circles, if somebody says, well, Joe is living with Mary now for the last 3 years and they're very happy, you're supposed to take that like as if he said about Joe that Joe has got a haircut. It's probably normal. If he says that, well, Joe and Michael decided that they were best buddies and they could give life support to each other, they love each other very much, meaning they have a homosexual union, you're supposed to, oh, really? That's bravo. I mean, you're not supposed to, or not common at all. You've got to get used to it, lad, because that's the way it is.
And anybody who objects to that will immediately be ostracized.
remember that every day, Bernard, to let our listeners know, every day on the international stock markets, say of Tokyo, Singapore, Berlin, Dusseldorf, Paris, Rome, Tokyo, London, New York, about $600 billion are sloshed around in various stock deals, perfectly legitimate. And there are hundreds of thousands of small investors all over the world. But there are only about up to 100 who deal every day on those markets, on all those markets, with about $20 to $40 billion. They know what's going on. They decide who lives and who dies. They govern money. They govern the flow of capital and capital goods to each country, without which country dies, on a daily basis. They decide, and they are, we are convinced, firmly in the camp of Lucifer. They serve his purpose to create a world without God, and a world which is inhuman in our sense of the word. They have a lot of power, and unfortunately they're going to try and, when we spoke a moment ago about the changes imposed on us in our eating, in our clothes, in the way what we hear on television, what we hear on radio, what we hear in films, what we hear in drama. We're talking about that. Remember those changes that were forced on us, and the clothes they're forcing on us. All those things are planned, because that's where the intelligence is, and it is definitely satanic. It's to wipe out Christian civilization. The devil has very little time to do it, and he has almost succeeded.
So Christianity is going to have no role in this new world order?
None. Paul VI, even poor Paul VI, who died in 1978, said that probably the church will be reduced to an infinitesimally small part of humanity. No influence whatever. Everybody would have walked over it, like countries like armies walked over Belgium in history and left it flat. They've walked over this whole society that we created for exorcism. They've walked over it. They simply walked beyond us. And there are several organizations that have failed too, because we're not able to manage it. We're not able to manage it. And these people are too powerful.
Does the struggle between good and evil enter into the church directly? Can Satan have an influence even inside the church?
From our experience, we have to say yes to that question. It's a difficult question to answer theoretically. Not that we don't know the theoretic principles behind Satan's penetration. You see, Satan is free to penetrate everywhere that human beings exercise free will. The book of Job has the classic example of that. At the beginning of the book of Job, Satan is confronted by God, and God says to him, "Look at my servant Job. Just a man you cannot find in the land." And Satan says to God in the story, which is only a story from that point of view, "Give me my chance. I will make him fall." And God says something like the equivalent of, "It's a free country. If you can make him fall, take him as your prey." And the principle is that anyone who is human, who has a free will, is liable. Now, that's all the apostles and all the bishops and all the priests and all the popes are free agents, so they can be tempted. Secondly, there's this, that, you know, Christ, speaking to the apostles on the Lake of Galilee after his resurrection, said to them all, "Satan has wanted to sieve you all like a man sieves wheat and chaff." And then turning to Peter, he says, "And you, especially." So he told them they'd be tempted. And the history of the church, or of churchmen as such, tells us that temptation and giving way to temptation has been the lot of churchmen from the very beginning. Even Peter himself yielded to fear, which was a temptation, and denied his Lord three times. And so there's no doubt about it, Satan can penetrate the church. What we must emphasize today, though, Bernard, is that the ordinary penetration of the church through its members by Satan has been demonstrated amply in the past. What we have never found in the history of the church since the ascension of our Lord, and that was when the church was really set up, the Pentecost and the Ascension, is that this is the first time we have undeniable proof that Satan has been enthroned in the church by some of the church's own churchmen, and that the citadel, which before was besieged with small breaches in it and small little traitors, now has Satan enthroned within it. And, you know, Paul VI, who ended up a very miserable pope, although he did his best, in the end of his life, he gave an interview to his great French friend, Jean Guiton, who later published it when he died. And at one stage, Jean Guiton said to him, Holiness, Sainteté, what do you think is the fate of the church going to be? You have said that the smoke of Satan has in the church and is wafting around the sanctuary altar. And Paul VI said, yes, he said, mon fils, my son, we have said that and it is true. The smoke of Satan is in the sanctuary. And probably Catholics are destined to become an infinitesimally small part of humanity due to the presence of Satan. And that means that in the mind of Paul VI, because they went on talking, Catholicism and Catholics and the Church will be marginalized completely because their impressive leaders would be taken over by the temptations of the devil. And what we must remember is this, that sure, there have always been temptations in the Church for churchmen, for gold, for sensuality, for pride and ambition. But this is the first time that a new assault has been launched. The assault is very simple. Just be like the rest of men. Adore a general God, be good, be compassionate men, be humanitarian, join man in building man's earthly world, earthly habitation in this world. And this is the first time this has cottoned on. And I must tell you that there's a bland note in documents coming out from bishops, the least you can say about them is that, and from Rome too, a certain human gallantry, a certain romanticism that has nothing to do with salvation. It is, let's share with humanity, humanity's labors. Let's join with man in helping man to solve his problems. The Church's aim is not to solve economic problems of man or political problems. The only victory the Church has, and the only victory Christ promised to the Church was when any man dies or any woman dies, they don't go to hell. They either go to purgatory or heaven because the Church has conveyed Christ's grace to them. It is undeniable that today Satan has entered the church in a very positive way. If you ask me further details on that, I must confess to you, Bernard, that I do not intend, from where I sit with my responsibilities, I do not intend to burden the imagination and the memory of your listeners with the details. But I must say this much, that Satan has been welcomed. Lucifer, the enemy of Christ, the tempter of Adam and Eve, he who hates Our Lady, he whose head she has crushed and will crush, he who finally will be blown away by the breath of Christ's mouth in the last day, who is responsible for all souls who went to hell, he has been successfully received and enthroned within the citadel. We are now not looking out at the enemy. The enemy is among us.
And your book, The Keys of This Blood, indicated that within Rome itself there exists a super force that has paralyzed the governing machinery of the Church, even in the Vatican.
That's what I'm talking about. There is this force which is at the present moment irremovable. I was going to say undislodgeable, but irremovable is a better English word. And this is where, again, one's faith in Our Lady of Fatima comes in. Because she said so. And she said that only I can save the Church because that is what my Son has willed, not because of her own choice, but because that's what Christ has chosen, that she shall be the one to come finally and save the Church before the final disaster. Because if you read carefully what Our Lady told Lucia, you get the strong picture that things are going to get so bad, so many of the elect will lose their faith, so many people who now believe will finally give up in despair, and commit suicide or be taken away by Satan as his prey, so much so that if she did not step in, nobody would be saved. And it reminds us of that awful phrase the gentle Christ used once when he's speaking to the apostles. They must have fallen out of their pants when they heard him say, when the Son of Man comes back to earth, he was talking about his resurrection and his disappearance, and then he's coming back on the last day. When I come back, am I going to find any faith on earth? You know, Bernard, that frightens me, because I consider myself to be strong in faith. And I now see that Christ would envisage in that sentence that I, who think I'm strong in faith, I might be dislodged. And that frightens my soul because I want to go to heaven. I don't want to go to hell. I don't want to burn forever, number one. And number two, I want to be in possession of eternal beauty and truth forever because that's my being who's made for that. I don't want to become the devil's booty, the devil's prey. So the danger is that Today, because the magisterium has a muffled voice, the office still exists. It is a muffled voice, an uncertain voice. The churchmen who are supposed to voice the magisterium have uncertain voices. They're affected in their faith. They're affected in their outlook. They're affected in their performance through fear and through what Our Lady called disequilibrium of mind. She said to Lucia once, "My child, don't be surprised if the best minds suffer from an imbalance at a certain moment. One can waver." And because that is so, there's a great crisis of faith in the church. And there's no point of recall. There's no rappel to order. There's no leading voice really talking in the church today, inspiring us all. It isn't there. So we're under siege very badly. And I'm not a pessimist or an optimist. I'm a realist. And if I look at the question of seminaries, if I look at the question of bishops, if I look at the question of the nuns, if I look at the question of theologians, Bernard, there's no light at the end of the tunnel yet. We're in the tunnel, and we're going to be in it for quite a while. There's no salvation coming so far. We've just got to weather this as best we can and keep our faith. And you know, the extraordinary phenomenon today is this, that when I was young, for instance, I'm 70, remember that, even if you were inclined to wonky and to waver and to divagate from the straight and narrow path, there was a community to support you. Your family, even the local cop, the local teacher, the schools, the library, your friends, the families, celebrations locally. There was a community. Today, there is no Catholic community. Anywhere. You have groups of 1 and 2 and 3 and 10. There's me on you and you on me, and we are our friends together. And there's other groups that meet, and it's one-on-one today. Small communities. There's no such thing as a unified parish. There is, probably, in the whole of the of America, I suppose, there are about 10 parishes that I know of, certainly, who are really united parishes. But there's an extraordinary priest there, an extraordinary parish priest in every one of those. And when he dies, the bishop is going to strip it. He has said so, because he dislikes all tradition. He wants it to be modern. So we have this condition today that we're all separated and broken up in small little bits. And that's what Christ has willed as our crucifixion. I always remind people, though, that when we say that, what we should remember is this, that all the fathers agree that the history of the church will reproduce exactly the history of Christ. And as far as I can see, if you want to draw a picture, a word picture of today, according to the image of Christ and his passion, you should say that, we have the crown of thorns, certainly, because we have those theologians on top of our back, Richard McCormick down here and Gandon up in Canada and people all over the place. And they're sticking thorns into our head and they're shaming us. And they're torturing us. And we're being scourged at the pillar. Yeah, we're being scourged because of our disgraceful behavior. Our pedophiliac priests and our Gucci nuns and our apostate bishops. And I could name off several dioceses in this country of ours, like, for instance, the Diocese of Albany. I consider it to be an apostate bishop. And the Diocese of Milwaukee with Bishop Wheatland, Archbishop Wheatland. And the others, and I think they probably themselves would agree to it. But this is all scourging of our public body. But we haven't yet started going to Calvary, carrying our cross, and we haven't reached Calvary, nor have we been crucified. Look at the lovely time that's ahead of us, Bernard, if we're going to follow that pattern of our Lord's sufferings.
That means that there's going to be a resurrection.
Of course there's going to be a resurrection, and we will be resurrected. And we'll be resurrected in glory, but after our crucifixion and death. And we have to suffer that, I'm afraid. And once that is over, once Our Lady comes on her appointed time, giving us the signal that she has promised to give us, then we can lift our faces to the east, because it's from the east our salvation will come. That is how Satan is working at the present moment. And there is no gainsaying his power in the church on account of the unfaith he has sown. He has so many supporters within the church now.
And let's take a look at the manifestations of this support that Satan has within the church. Let's say heresies like liberation theology or this New Age philosophy. Yeah. Could you maybe describe briefly some of the worst ones?
Well, I'll tell you, you've named two principal ones. Liberation theology, of course, was, as you know, concocted with one deliberate reason in mind. In the 50s, they did this. Sat down carefully in Panama City, a group of people, Catholic theologians and Marxists, and they worked out the following, that there was no way you could touch the Catholicism directly of Latin American peoples. They're just their culture, their very names, their salutations, their the names of the week, everything they did, even when they cursed, it implied religion. So they said, why don't we use Catholic terminology in a Marxist sense, but still using it? So they set out to speak about La Virgen, the Virgin, who is the mother of revolutionaries, Madre de la Revolución, and speak about Christ, the bread of the workers. But when they said El Pan de los Trabajadores, they meant Christ, the bread of the workers, which we make in our factory, we've taken from the capitalists, and so on. They Marxized every Christian concept, or they Christianized every Marxist concept. And it was a very subtle thing, because it wiped out, there was no such thing as personal sin. The only sin they want to liberate themselves from, themselves from, was capitalism, Yankee capitalism. That was the enemy. But liberación didn't mean any liberation from sin by the blood of Christ. That didn't matter. And you know, at the famous meeting of the liberation theologians in Brazil in 1987, with 12 bishops and I don't know how many priests and how much lay people, everybody went and trod on the crucifix. Because they said the crucifix and the passion of Jesus, this enervates our fighting revolutionary power. And they have started off on that line. Now, unfortunately, you see, liberation theology has fallen very evil days because Moscow has ceased to support them. And the great vindicator and champion of liberation theology in this part of the world, Mr. Castro, is sinking beneath the waves with a stiff upper lip. And he's on his way out slowly. So they have, but it has created terrible damage because while it's now seeping out of Latin America slowly, it's not out of it yet, it's still ensconced in North America in the seminaries and in England, where they're all liberation theologians. And you dare speak to them about going to confession, they say, for what? There's no such thing as personal sin. Sin is social sin, sinful structure, sinful governments. And we're not sinful governments, just the government we have is. So that's one great sin, one great heresy, and it's still there and it's troubled the church. The second one is more pervasive, and it's the New Age. Bernard, you've heard about political correctness. It's the rage now in New York, in Los Angeles, in California, in down south, in Dallas and Fort Worth, all over the United States, in our courts, in our newspapers. There are certain things you cannot say, otherwise you are not politically correct and socially acceptable. You cannot, for instance, be openly advocating celibacy. Oh, you don't do that. That's medieval, and it's superstitious, and it produces all these pedophiliac priests. And that's the argument against it. Priests should marry and have the option at least to be able to marry, and therefore they get rid of their bad instincts. They wouldn't become deviants. Another thing political correctness forbids is any attack on homosexuality as a sin. It's not. It's an alternative way of life. Any attack on abortion. No, it's a legitimate constitutional right of every red-blooded American man and woman to have an abortion or to procure an abortion. The new world is built on one principle. The new world is built on the principle that man, if left alone by religion and religionists and hierarchical authorities, is able to build a paradise on earth. And you want to worship the Virgin? Fine, worship her, but worship her with us. Let us all share it and be sane. Have an even, plain surface during which we, on which we can all worship as we want to worship, but leave the other alone. Don't say he's wrong. He's just as right as you, and you're just as right as him. This is the new age. Of course, we will have to worship one Father, because there's only one God, you Christians say, you Catholics say. We agree to that. But it's the Father of the earth. It's the Father of fruit and flowers, Father of lambs, Father of fruitful gardens and trees and meadows, and Father for all our agriculture, Father for our technology. That's real God. Because that helps man. It's no longer a dominant, hierarchic, exclusivist, paternalistic, patriarchal church demanding sacrifices and waiting for pie in the sky. There's no pie in the sky. The pie is here. And there's enough for everybody if you Catholics and religionists will stop being exclusivist and join in. That's the New Age. And the New Age is more subtle than anything else, because I'll tell you why. The essence of the New Age technique now being taught to companies and to company executives is self-control. And the exercises of the New Age being used in seminars, paid for thousands of dollars by big companies like GM and several of the big companies in the United States, consists in submitting your mind to a discipline. And when we examine the discipline from our point of view here, we find out that discipline is almost the same as TM. It does the very same silencing of your faculties and leaves you wide open to any influence that will come in. Now, I'll tell you one thing. Whatever other influences are out there looking for a point of entry, there's one influence roaming around like a lion, seeking whom he may devour, and that is Lucifer. And if you adopt this, the mental attitude that they are trying to inculcate the New Agers, as they call them, you'll find that you are sitting duck for the most amazing row of influences. And we think that it's partly the rise of the New Age system of egalitarian treatment of all religions and the submission of the mind and the opening up of the spirit to the great force. We have found that the rise of that is coetaneous, is simultaneous with the rise of this intense diabolism, intense Satanism. So there must be some organic connection between the two. We're persuaded that there is a connection between the two. The New Age is pernicious because, see, it's good, it's compassionate. It says don't kill, don't steal, don't kill little children, don't conceive them either. But that's the most merciful way of not doing things. And don't overpopulate the world, and don't make war. No, make love. Join in the technological and industrial advancement of all peoples. And don't see black or white or sky blue or pink. Color doesn't matter. So it sounds very democratic, it sounds very compassionate, it sounds very human. The only thing is that Christianity, the message of Christ, is not democratic, it's not human, it's supernatural, and it's meant to prepare us for eternity. So the New Age is the subtlest attack on the church. It has invaded the church. And the amount of Catholics who now become Freemasons, say, or join organizations that are very anti-Catholic, is due to the fact that the leavening of this New Age mentality. You said that, haven't we been fighting long enough with each other? Why can't we sit down and practice love and agree with people and agree to build with them? What's wrong with that? And if I have a cathedral in Pittsburgh and you have no cathedral and you're a Methodist or a Lutheran, well, have my cathedral because we're all worshiping the same God. And so the mixture and the syncretism of all religions start, and you find a mixture. Say you find a meeting in Detroit of the local chapter of an international Jewish organization, meeting in unison with the confraternity of the Sacred Heart and the Jewish and the Masonic Lodge, all perfectly good brothers in the Lord and sisters in the Lord. So they have sort of an amalgam, and they all feel good about it. And the Catholics worship Christ, and the Jews worship God, and the Masons have their own version of God. But we're all human, so it leaves you in peace. And there's cooperation, financial, social, political, and there's peace. Isn't that what we're all supposed to do, Bernard? So it's a very tempting thing. Instead of some fiery pope or some fiery theologian or some subtle preacher saying, no, there's a basic truth. Outside the church, there's no salvation. You can't be a good anything but a good Catholic if you want to be saved. One way or the other, you have to get grace through Christ, through the church. That's unacceptable, politically incorrect, and socially unacceptable today. So that's the great crisis in the church from the point of view of faith. The crisis undermining the church from another side is the crisis of the papacy.
Now, related to a New Age philosophy, of course, is the feminist ideology, which has also pervaded the church recently.
It has. Feminism is a new sort of not a heresy. It's not a heresy because they haven't been able to work out, despite their best efforts, and there's a flood of books burned for the last 5-7 years. I stopped buying the books finally, unless it's an outstanding book, outstanding in Venom or outstanding in historical research. But the flood of documents supporting feminism and pushing it is so great that you can't speak about it as a heresy, because they have not found a theological framework to justify their claims. But what they have is an intense emotion and passion. And it's a very funny thing, though, that when you come to talk to feminists and frequent their organizations and frequent their circles and their study groups, you always find two things coming immediately. You find that as they progress in their feminism, their feminist passion and the feminist emotion, feminist enthusiasm, they always end up with some form of Wicca. And Wicca is the old, old witchcraft wherein the goddess Gaia and Sophia are worshipped, and in which lesbian love is blessed, and in which the earth is venerated as divine, and in which no mention of the son or the father are allowed. It's the mother and the daughter. In other words, feminism, theologically speaking, this is why they find it difficult to formulate an acceptable theology, because people are still inclined to have traditional ideas, is this. Feminism aims directly at the heart of the Trinity. Like homosexuality, it wants to wipe out the idea of fatherhood and sonhood and daughterhood. It wants to have womanhood. And that's why they speak about woman church. Just that's the whole thing, womanhood and woman church. That's all there is. The rest is accretion, cultural accretion, and religious religious burdens taken over from patriarchal men and churchmen. It is, I suppose, if you were to ask me what is the most blasphemous form of side of Satan's attack on society, it is his sowing of feminism. It's a direct insult to Our Lady. She is the queen of heaven and the mother of all the living. She is the example of purity, chastity, motherhood, daughterhood. She's daughter of the Most High. She's mother of the Most High. And she's also the model of the wife. She was a real wife, a real spouse of Saint Joseph. That's all attacked. Spouse, marriage, that's nothing to do with feminism, whatever. Women must be liberated from that. And lesbian love does liberate them from that.
So it's an attack on the family?
Ultimately on the Trinity. Because through the family, they hope to attack the Trinity. Because if the family is wiped out in human society, the Trinity ceases to exist. It's the ultimate aim is the Trinity, and that is Satan's hatred of that Trinity of divine persons that said, be damned, go to hell. And that's his weapon against it. And if he can destroy that, once you wipe out the Trinity, once you wipe out the whole idea of fatherhood and sonhood and daughterhood, and destroy the family, then there is no longer a divine family, there's no longer a human family, there's nothing but chaos. And that's in the social order, that's the most blasphemous success and effort that Satan has put through. The shame is this. The shame and the pity of women is this. Negatively speaking, the shame is this. Since women have got so far in entering what they call the patriarchal society, society hasn't got more merciful. The pilots, women pilots of helicopters and gunships who went to the Gulf were just as bloody-minded as the men. And we know that female executives in firms are the worst, the hardest to take. Men say, no, give me a crotchety old man any time you like. Give me the biggest son of a gun you can find, but not a woman. Cruel and merciless beyond belief once they depart from their role as women. That's the negative side of the shame. The positive side of the shame is that being called, by the very fact of being a woman, being called to be a replica of Our Lady, her beauty, her motherhood, her virginity, her purity, her daughterhood, and her closeness to God. And how closer can a human person be than by being, having eternity in your womb and your model being the mother of God, personal model. Such an honor conferred on any woman who wants to imitate it, and they have rejected it. It's the shame of feminism. And it makes one cry at the lack of wisdom, the lack of perception, and also the hatred Satan has. He remembers one day in the garden when he was told, wait for her, for her heel. She's going to walk on your heel. She's going to walk on your head. You're going to be crushed by a woman. And her seed will be your undoing. So he hates that. You know, there's one scene when Marie Bernadette Soubirous was having the first visions of Our Lady in Lourdes. Remember that scene, the third time she came down, she found the lady standing there with yellow roses in her feet and a yellow sash and this marvelous face, and she was smiling. She was smiling. And she had this strange joy. And when Bernadette said to her, who are you? She had this extraordinary joy, and she said, I am the Immaculate Conception. Said it in Bernadette's dialect. And then, but the first day Bernadette went down, she didn't know what to do. And she had an apron, and she always kept her rosary beads in the apron. She got her rosary beads because she thought it was the devil. And started saying the Our Father. And she saw a lady take her own rosary beads from her sash and say the Our Father, silently. And then she went to the first Hail Mary, and she saw Mary's fingers moving to the first bead. And so she went through the whole deck, and then she suddenly realized that it wasn't the devil. The devil wouldn't say the rosary. She progressed in talking at the second or third day, and then the word spread around the local peasantry to which she belonged, she was a peasant girl, that she was talking to the La Vierge. So all the peasants came down beside her, and they used to pass notes over to her and whisper, say, ask Our Lady to cure my calf, ask Our Lady to bring my husband back from Paris. Request them, and Our Lady was laughing at them pleasantly and saying, yes, I will, no, I can't, etc. And at a certain stage, in the middle of this, when they could only hear Bernadette's voice giving the messages and getting the answers from this virgin they couldn't see, in another of the caves, because this place was lined with grottos and caves, they heard the dirtiest, most threatening, smelling voice of about 1,000 lions hungry for flesh. It was obviously Satan's disruption of the scene. And everybody hushed. There wasn't a sound. When they heard this, like wild animals waiting to tear you limb from limb. And Bernadette sort of appealed to Our Lady. And all Our Lady did, she didn't say a word, she just turned her head and looked at the mouth of the cave and silence. Silence. That's Our Lady's power. And if they only realize that's what they can inherit as women. If they want to change society, they want to cure men's chauvinism, she's the one who can do it. If they turn to her, you know, they want to make the human race more compassionate, she's the mother of all compassion. Oh, what a shame they missed that opportunity, missed their vocation, missed their vocation. And they're killing the fruit of their own womb. What are they going to say to Our Lady when she says, I was a mother too? And you were a mother and you killed your baby? You killed three babies? And here they are looking at you. What does a woman say when she faces that accusation? What depth of hell is deep enough to hide you? Where can you hide from your shame?
In our discussion earlier, you just touched on the subject of Satan's assault on the papacy. Perhaps we could have a brief discussion about that.
But if we didn't speak about the papacy before the end of this conversation, I know that by the autumn of 1992, this year, you certainly would be very angry and disappointed with me. By the spring of 93 and well into May, June and July of that year, I don't think you would ever speak to me again, because I would have let you down. I wouldn't have brought to your notice what I think is fatally necessary for every Catholic to know, and that is the fate of the papacy and the coming stress and danger that we shall be without the strength of the papacy. Now let me explain what I'm talking about. There would be no difficulty in the eyes of the Church's enemies, both the seeker organizations, the one to take a hold of the Church, and in the eyes of all the dissident theologians, there would be no difficulty in being Catholic if the papacy ceased to be an active, influential, and jurisdictional element, authoritative or authoritative element. If the Pope, or whoever is supposed to be the Pope, the Bishop of Rome, were just one amongst his peers, a fellow bishop, prominent because he is the most ancient chancellor in the most ancient church, and St. Peter, after all, was in Rome, and Paul was in Rome, and Rome has always been the center. But that's all. If that was all, it was a question of honor and veneration, and the man behaved himself like one of us, as a peer amongst his peers, there would be no difficulty, nor would the secret enemies of the church have ever sought to possess the Rome, to enter into it, and nor would Satan ever have wafted his smoke in there. It's a waste of time otherwise. The prize, the booty to be taken away and devoured is the papacy. Now, we want to be very clear what we mean by papacy. We do not mean the tiara, the triple crown. We do not mean the gold in the Vatican museums. We don't mean the papal thrones. We don't mean anything grandiose and valuable from the point of view of riches or prestige or influence. We just mean one thing, that the papacy implies that there is one individual, a man, on the face of the earth who claims and can back up that claim with historical proof and the weight of divine faith, that he, and he alone, in a population of 6 billion, is the only one who can speak about God authoritatively to any man alive. He's the only one who claims it, and the only one who can back it up. And he's the only one who, first of all, backs it up by proving that he is the one of 264 men going back link by link through bad, good, and indifferent, saint and sinner, the bishops of Rome, back to the first bishop of Rome, who was told by Jesus, whoever listens to you listens to me. Thou art Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church. Whatever you loose here on earth will be loosed in heaven. Whatever is tied up here, it will be tied up in heaven. Because the gates of hell will never prevail against you. And he has that direct historical connection. It is the pain of the Protestants who started in the 16th century, or the Unitarians who started later, or the Methodists, to find that they are woebegone waifs of the centuries that started up like abortions and have no direct historical connection with the historic Jesus of history and the first men who came out with the faith and the Pentecostal tradition and revelation he gave them. Now, that's the papacy. It means that one thing essentially, there's one man who must be listened to under certain conditions, who is the only one who can claim that legitimately, and despite all his sins, if he does commit sin, despite all his errors, if he does commit errors, despite his bad leadership, his weakness, his unfaith, if he has all those things, he must still be listened to once he speaks dogmatically for the whole of the human race on faith and morals. That's a huge claim, because it means that literally tomorrow, the U.S. Congress should invite him over, tell them what to do about morality and dogma. It means the Houses of Parliament in England. It means every parliament should have his delegate telling them what is human morality and religion to be. It will not be like that easily. It will not happen like that. The world has rejected the idea. But that's what it implies. And it is not strange, by the way, that the enemies of the church, those who dislike us for one reason or another, justified or unjustified, know that. They know that ultimately that is his claim. And that is the message of The Keys of This Blood, my last book. And that those keys, you know, the scene which we probably know very well of Catherine Siena with the vision she had of the keys of Peter dipped in blood. And God the Father said to her, Catherine, which are those keys? And she said, those are the keys you gave to Peter. And he said, yes. And why are they covered with blood? She asked him, he said, because they will never cease to be durable. They will last forever and they will never break. And that's why the keys of this blood, the message is that this one man, this Polish archbishop, this cardinal, Karol Wojtyła, who does not sit well with the majority of the 3,000 bishops of this beloved church of ours, and who is hated by so many nuns and so many priests and so many lay people and disliked by so many secular governments, this man is the only man on the face of the earth whom you can in any way trustingly believe is the voice of Christ. That's a huge claim. Now, that's a stumbling block for the world, and it's absolute folly for most of our modern society. It's a stumbling block for them because they know that despite all the denigration they've done of the papacy, despite the mistakes of the papacy, because the papacy has made terrible mistakes in the last 100 years, terrible mistakes. In the last 200 years, fatal mistakes. Despite that, the prestige, the power, and the influence, and the peculiar moral suasion this Pope has, and the papacy has, once he exercises it, miracles happen. Now, the miracles they don't want to happen are those that impede the creation of a one-world government, that impede the homogenization of all education, that impede the imposition of population control, in the real sense of the word population control, because I want to speak to you about that word in a moment, because that term means much more than babies, or limitation of births. But what they hate about it is this, that papacy is the biggest obstacle to that, because they know that if he were to act in full flush of his power and jurisdiction and authority, he could overturn them. And they've seen this so near them in their own time. They know, who has it said, qui mange pape meurt, whoever strikes the Pope dies. It was somebody who struck the Pope, Napoleon. And on Helena, he's supposed to have said, when somebody asked him, Empereur, what really happened? He said, I struck the Pope. Whoever strikes the Pope dies. I didn't know it. And to give him his due, Mussolini, when he, in the early days when he was against Hitler, and Hitler was striking the church in Germany, said, whoever strikes the church, the Pope dies. Benito even recognized that. Then he proceeded to strike the Pope, and he died. And the Pope remained. You know the old story about how many divisions the Pope has, Joseph Stalin. Same thing. They know there's this inherent power. They don't want to stir it up. They just want the papacy to go away. Now, if they can do that, we have no longer got Peter. That's not enough. Because there have been periods in the church when we haven't got a pope for 10 years, for 3 years, for one whole year. Several times when they couldn't elect a pope, there was too much jealousy and bickering amongst the sacred cardinal electors, or because the church was disrupted and there were wars on, the electors couldn't get together in one place. So the existence of an actual pope doesn't destroy the papacy. It's the institution. Now, to give you an example of their mind, the ideal mind. When John XXIII was pope, he was carried around on a thing called the sedia gestatoria. It was a platform, actually, made of silver. Beautiful thing, mother. You can see it today. And it was carried by 9 lusty men on either side. All the same height, exactly the same height, dressed in beautiful hose and special coifs for their hair. And they had shoulder pads. They were trained to move, so there was no jogging. The pope was carried along. And the first time I saw a pope was 1938. And I saw Pius XII carried, 1939, I saw Pius XII carried into St. Peter's. And I started crying when I saw this. It's a glorious sight. And when he stood, and especially when he got down off that and was on his throne, but also in it, they had 2 flambeaux, they called it French, 2 fans made of ostrich feathers encased in silver casings. It must have cost a fortune in silver. It was South American silver, just beautiful silver. And it was a gift, and studded with precious stones and gems and opals and emeralds. It hasn't been used since the time John Paul I was the last one he used and then just put aside. John Paul II has never used it. Where is it now? It's in the Vatican Museum. It's a relic. Will it ever be used again? God knows. I doubt it. What will happen to it? It will remain there for a couple of 100 years, perhaps 1,000 years, if the church lasts, if the world lasts 1,000 years, as a relic of a very ancient and beautiful custom, now quaint and utterly impractical. That is the status to which they wish to reduce the papacy. Both our enemies and the theologians and the apostate bishops. A nice relic, venerable, intensely valuable. Intensely venerable because Peter, because of Paul, because of Innocent III, because of Gregory the Great, because of Leo the Great, because of the great man, what it did in the past. But that's all over. It's now a relic like the Scibella, the sedia gestatoria in the museum. Let's admire it, let's study the stones, and wonder at the primitive minds and the quaint mentality of those who could use such a thing or have such a thing. That's the state they want for the Pope. So that the whole idea of papacy and Christ-like jurisdiction fades out. Now, that is their aim. If they can do that by hook or by crook, then there is no longer a papacy. And you know, Christ said, the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. If that were to happen, it is the end. It is the end.
Is it ever possible that the cardinals at a future conclave could elect a heretical pope?
You know, they have elected men in the past who had heretical ideas. 2 or 3. They have never elected yet an apostate. An apostate. Because, after all, Origen was heretical in various ways, and still he's regarded almost with the status of the father of the church. And Pope Liberius, you know, had some very funny ideas about the status of Christ's will, but he wasn't an apostate. An apostate has rebelled against the very fundamental of faith and rejected God and Christ. We have apostates now who are papabili. Yes, we could have an apostate. But in that day, and then we are into something terrible. We're into something which, Bernard, is something that, if you think on it in full knowledge of the meaning of your terms, is nightmarish. It would test the faith of St. Calvin of Siena. It would test the faith of the greatest saint. It would try the patience of Job. It will be a black day, a day on which you can clothe every window in black and put out the lights, and dress in sackcloth and ashes, and pray that you're spared, because your faith is going to be battered to pieces if that happens. Because then they have the prize. And everything goes underground. And we are indeed and then on our way to becoming what Paul VI in his misery called in 1978 an infinitesimally small part of humanity, completely marginalized and pushed to the side and forgotten as a quaint group of people as interesting as Tibetan astrologers on a modern campus.
Let's now take a bit of a look at the whole concept of an underground church, because I think to a certain extent, let's say in the United States and Canada and Europe, we do have a situation where we have an underground church that exists.
I'm glad you said that, Bernard, because I was going to say, if you hadn't made that added on that writer, I would have said to you, listen, we needn't look for a concept. We have it. You see, there's a basic thing, I think, which I must insist on saying to you, Bernard, and be patient with me now for one moment. Anybody looking at the church today can see in the facade, in the appearance, all the elements that were there in 1950. Pope, bishops, cardinals, priests, nuns, newspapers, seminaries, Dawson newspapers, institutes, publishing houses, missions, orders, religious orders of nuns and priests. The facade is there. The terrible thing is, what most people cannot allow themselves admit is that it is an illusion. The organization as it was then does not exist now. There's an illusion. The institutional organization that functioned then, that kept the Pope coagulated with the bishops with the priests with the nuns and the people, and a whole flow of obedience and command flowing up and down, carefully nourished in doctrine and discipline and rule and punishment for infraction of rules, and kept the cohesion tight, is gone. Doesn't exist. There are no 10 bishops that agree on anything. There are no 200 priests that agree on anything. There is no cohesion about the real presence of the Blessed Sacrament, about devotion to Our Lady, about the value of celibacy, about the value of purity, about the value of marriage, about the value of human life. We're riven with it. And our people, 77% of American Roman Catholics practice contraception. 52% believe in abortion as a choice. Homosexuality is accepted by 46%. What is this? And we have just barely half going to Mass and Communion, enough to satisfy their obligations. It's not as bad as Austria, where it's 5%, but it's pretty bad. And we have rife homosexuality in the seminaries run by the bishops, and we have heretics teaching in the seminaries run by bishops. Come on, the church doesn't exist. And Rome can't do anything about it. And Mr. Ratzinger, Cardinal Ratzinger, can do nothing about it. The Pope can't do anything about it. They know it all. And when we find that there's a ring of priests in the Archdiocese of Chicago, which has been practicing satanic pedophilia amongst themselves and killing any dissident member of their own group, for how many years past, and nobody's done anything about it, and they've known about it? Facade. Of course it's a facade. The church doesn't exist as it did exist, the church organization. What you and I must remember is that our pride is that we belong to a corporate body called the mystical body of Jesus, which is real as the nose in your face, but it's spiritual. It means that once you're in the state of grace, whether you're here on earth or in purgatory or in heaven, you form one mystical body of grace and happiness in Trinitarian subsistence. That we do belong to. The visible organization which started off with Peter and James and John running helter-skelter to avoid Jewish persecution and go to the Gentiles and being thrown off walls and drowned in the rivers and given over to animals to be eaten and run through with spears and crucified upside down. All that was the visible church then. This, what we saw in the 1950s, didn't exist then. It wasn't necessary and isn't necessary now. And God is letting it be taken away from us. So we have a facade of a church, which isn't the organizational institution of the church proper. And then we have the underground church. And that's composed of a minority of Catholics today. A minority certainly in the United States, a minority in Canada and Australia and New Zealand and in Europe, and a minority over in Africa and Asia. It's a minority. It's underground because the authorities want to get rid of it. They want to persecute them. They want to push them out. The priests, they try to defrock them, try to let them hang in the wind slowly, or convert and be nice conciliar Catholics. The marriages, they have so bastardized with their annulments that now we speak about Catholic divorce, because the annulment they give, most of them are not real real annulments, they're real divorces, but they're being easy, making it easy for people. And we have the toleration of homosexuality, and we have the toleration of various other things that utterly are incompatible. So many people said, this is bad. I'm going to organize my smaller group with my wife, my husband, my children, my friends. We're going to have a priest comes privately, says Mass for us, gives us Holy Communion. If we can't have that, we're going to have Holy Communion in the basement in a tabernacle. And we will distribute it ourselves. And there'll be a rider priest comes around every so often, instructs the children, and distributes Holy Communion. Here's confessions. So we now have a full-blown underground church, which doesn't call itself that, which is deliberately not sticking its nose above ground, which is staying away from controversy, but creating its own ambient and its own congregations. And the bishops don't know that, and the authorities don't seem to care. Some of them don't even know what it means, because they think that once they have the facade, and once they have the money coming in and the properties, that they have the church. They have lost their faith. They don't know what's going on. And now, that is the condition of the church. There is an underground church, and it's going to be bigger. Unfortunately, it is being ravaged by cults. Because, as you know, we have a plethora of seers and visionaries, and people coming along with what Our Lady said to them last night, and what Our Lord told to them yesterday, and very long speeches Our Lord and Our Lady make to them. I didn't think Our Lord had so many words, or Our Lady said so many words. But this is creating devastation because cults introduce divisiveness. And some of them claim to be the cult, the proper way, and others just claim that they're all equal. So it's divisiveness. It's Satan again trying to bother it all. There is an underground church. That's the conclusion.
Is it justified under these circumstances?
Absolutely. If the only way that you can have your children go to confession and Holy Communion and you can hear a Mass at least once a month and receive the body and blood of Christ truly once a month, there is no question in my mind. Because without that, you're not going to save your soul. You won't have sanctifying grace. You'll slip. You'll break up. And so it's necessary.
Now, let's take a look at another question. Suppose there is a dissident theologian or an apostate bishop. Are they part of the mystical body of Christ or not?
No. An apostate has ceased to be. That's why no apostate bishop can receive obedience. You're free from all obedience to an apostate. Once he's an apostate, you don't owe him any obedience. Now, he can call the canon law on you, and he can call the civil law on you if you want to, stand on his rights. But before God, in genuine Christian justice, he has no authority. He should have been deposed long ago. And the 5 or 6 or 10 well-known apostate bishops we have in the United States, and the 2 or 3 that you're enjoying over in Canada, should already have been removed long ago by the people and by the church. They're not, but you have no obligation to obey them. A heretic, if he is really a heretic, then he's in mortal sin. And nobody should pay any attention to him. We should pray for him. That's all. The apostate bishop should be deposed.
So we're in a situation there where the institutional church does not necessarily line up with the mystical body of Christ.
No, it does not. It does not. And remember that at the time of the Arians, as Newman pointed out in his examination of the Arian heresy, what restored the church? Remember, first of all, the Arian heresy had attracted 81% of the bishops. And St. Basil of Nyssa, St. Basil the Great, and Gregory of Nyssa said that when they went traveling and preaching at that time, when they went into a church dominated by the Arians, they never mentioned Jesus, they never mentioned the Holy Ghost. They only spoke God the Father, because the Arians didn't believe in anything else. So they knew what it was like. But Newman points out that the person who saved the church, who finally got rid of the Arians, were not the clergy, not the Pope, the people. In their faith, the belly of the faith in the people, finally shed them as alien material. It took 300 or 400 years. Arians didn't die out from the church until about the beginning of the 7th century. They were as pernicious as that. Similarly here too, it will be the people themselves, God in the people, who reject them. But then they have to turn to the lawful authority of the church when there is a lawful authority that consents to exercise its responsibilities and tell the people the truth of Revelation.
Let's look very briefly now at Satan's assault on the very liturgy itself.
That was a very successful assault. The objective was very simple. Satan's objectives are terribly simple, but they're always essential. I think we said before, the day that the Mass ceases to be said. That is the end, not only of the Church, but of the world. Why do I say that? Because the Mass is a reproduction, a reenactment, exact and complete, of Calvary. It is Calvary itself, in an unbloody manner. And that daily offering, as the prophet Malachi calls it, is the pure offering from the rising of the sun to the going down of the same, which staves off God's anger and wins all the grace of the world. If that ceased to be, then it is the end of the Church and the end of the world. There's no doubt about it. Christianity would go down and into that black hole would go the world with it. Because there's no longer any grace, there's no longer any sacrifice, it's all over. It's all over. And I think hell must be that terrible absence of all grace. Even in the concentration camps of World War II, they were able to have surreptitious masses and secret in the bunkhouse offerings of that sacrifice. This time there would be none if it were to die out. Now, I am always amazed at the horror, the hatred for the Mass, especially in many of our bishops and priests. I'm a priest. If tomorrow I went down to the local church, St. Vincent Ferrer's, at 66th and Lexington, I wore Bermuda shorts, and I wore a rugby shirt on, and I had a yellow cap, and I had two cockatoos on my shoulder, and proceeded to say a new innovative Mass, that they would be amazed at my creativity. If I went down in square Roman vestments and started off saying, in truibur altare Dei, they would call the police. That's the difference. There is a hatred of the Mass. Bishop Keith Simons of Florida has contemptuously spoken about the slaughterhouse priests, which is the biggest slur possible on the bloody sacrifice of Christ, because they're slaughterers, he says. And another bishop has spoken about those priests that have their face to the wall and talk to themselves, talking about the old Mass, with the altar oriented to God, with the people behind them oriented to God too. Their contempt for the Mass and their hatred, their effort to stop the Mass being said, even when the Pope appealed to them twice in this decade alone, give the people that Mass they want. They won't. Many of them do grudgingly and hoping it'll die out, and they try and adulterate it with other ceremonies. That's the pity of it all. The plot, the way of doing that was through a man called Bugnini, Annibale Bugnini, a Monsignor, now dead and gone to God and judged. I'm sure Annibale has seen the light. Where he ended up, God only knows. May God have mercy on his soul, because he was a very evil man, who quite honestly said, I want to make the Mass such that any Protestant, any Jew, any human being can partake in it and feel at home. How about that for the exclusivist church? How about that for the church outside of which there is no salvation? And he did succeed. He produced a Mass, as you know, which was so bad, so heretical, and promulgated by Paul VI, that two cardinals went to Paul VI and said, promulgate that and we'll declare you a heretic. He withdrew it. It wasn't a Mass at all. It was a bastardized form. With no sacrifice, no priest, no altar, no offertory. And then he produced a modified form of that, putting in words here and there, which Bugnini put in for him, and created the present mishmash of a Novus Ordo that we have, which normally is invalid. You've got to make an effort to make the Novus Ordo valid. You can make it valid, but you've got to make an effort. Of itself, it's going to be invalid. And that he has imposed on the Universal Church. And I've been to hundreds of Masses, I've been in my business, of Novus Ordos, just to notice the ritual. And the vast majority are invalid. And sometimes when you speak to the priest afterwards, you know, it's no wonder he doesn't believe there's a thing called the sacrifice of Calvary. He doesn't believe in grace. He doesn't believe in hell. He doesn't believe in a savior. He believes in having a communal celebration where everybody loves each other and kisses each other when they shake hands. He doesn't believe in the Mass as a salvific act of Christ on the altar with the people in veneration and adoration. He doesn't believe in that any longer. Nor do the nuns, many of them. Many of them do. There are many good priests, there are many good nuns, but they're in a minority, a vast minority, and the bishops who believe in it are in a vast minority. I think anybody who wants to find out how bad it can be should read the pastoral letter of Cardinal Archbishop Mahoney of Los Angeles on the Blessed Sacrament. I assure you that there isn't a guru in India or a swami in India who wouldn't be delighted with that letter and could read it as a guru or a swami, I'd be perfectly content. I'd never think of becoming a Catholic. From that, it's quite obvious, Cardinal Mahoney does not believe in the real presence and does not believe in the real sacrifice of Calvary. Doesn't believe in it. If he does, he has so carefully hidden it that he should be get a prize.
Now let's summarize these series of interviews. We've taken a look at Satan's assault on individual souls, on the world's political systems, and on the church itself. And it's a very scary picture. Is there any hope for us? And how is this all going to end up?
There is hope. More than hope. We have surety. We are assured that everything is going to be optimum and better than it ever was before. But we also have the assurance that Christ had when he knew that he would rise again on the third day and ascend gloriously into heaven and reign forever. He knew, and we know, that in between us and that successful outcome of our present quandary and misery is going to be extremely painful. We know that from history. We know that from Scripture. We know it from Fatima. We know it from what the present Pope is always saying and keeps on saying, and even Cardinal Ratzinger keeps on saying. The worst is yet to come before it turns around. There is no light at the end of the tunnel. So we have no hope to avoid trouble. And that's why I'm always saying to my nieces and nephews, you don't know it, but you've lived the best years of your American lives. You don't know it. And some of them are not Catholics, some of them are. Now, that's for sure. So we're commenting on a very dire situation into which we have been plunged, not by God, but by the mistakes of men, the mistakes of popes, the mistakes of bishops, the mistakes of priests, the mistakes of nuns, and the mistakes of lay people. Everybody has had their share in it. But God's law is that he punishes the whole race for the sins of few, as he did with Adam and Eve. As he does with the family where the father and mother are sinful, the children are immediately affected by it. So we're going to be affected by it.
Thank you, Father Martin, for participating in these interviews.
Bernard, it has been a pleasure and a blessing. God bless you and God bless our listeners.